Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Full of Hot
and Cold
Air. On today's episode, we're finally talking HVAC, specifically VRF, with a sprinkle of early adoption. Here we go.
Sticking with us. This is episode number, what are we on? Five?
Five.
Five. Five episodes in. We're really doing it. So
we're still here.
We're still here. So thanks to everybody that's been tuning in. We've noticed that we've reached a little bit of a crossroads with the
already?
Podcast.
Five episodes in,
and we're pivoting a little bit.
It's a quick pivot.
It is a quick pivot. We're at this crossroads of, okay, do we want to talk really broad terms such as like business topics, ideas, culture, that sort of thing, or do we take it a little bit more narrow and talk technical knowledge, product knowledge? We want to appeal to a pretty wide audience here. So
yeah, I think the engagement has shown us that there's not only HVAC companies interested in hearing what we've got to say, but small businesses as well.
Yeah, so we don't want to bore people that are tuning in for the small business and start talking product knowledge and all of that.
Exactly.
We certainly don't need to hit that unsubscribe button.
We want to keep smashing the subscribe. So yeah. what we're going to do is split our content a little bit and bring some shorter, more defined episodes to the podcast. Mary Beth, what are we going to call those?
Cold Blast.
Cold Blast. So those will be very clear, probably released. I would say we're doing Full of Hot Air on Tuesdays. I think we'll shoot for maybe like a Thursday release of the Cold Blast. And that'll be really industry specific. We'll be trying to talk technical knowledge, technical troubleshooting, product support, product application, sales strategies, everything as it relates really specifically to the HVAC industry, and try and give our contractors and HVAC listeners really something to dig their teeth into.
And so if you've been tuning in week after week to listen to us banter, you're still in luck. We are still going to continue the Tuesday release.
I'm still
episodes.
Stuck with you once
you're
a week.
You're still stuck with me once a week. And also every day forever. So if you're tuning in to listen to us, we are still going to have our weekly episodes. And on those episodes, we're going to talk broad topics. So that's small business questions, social media, culture, ideas. Anything is pretty much on the table with regards to those. But again, if you are tuning in because you're listening for, or you're hoping to hear something very industry related, keep an eye out for those Cold Blast episodes. Those will be applicable to you.
Yeah, and today I think we're going to start with a little bit of a hybrid episode. Is that right, Maribel?
Yeah, we came up with this topic before we decided to diverge our two podcast ideas here. So this is going to be a hybrid today. We are talking VRF, which is very specific to the HVAC industry. And we're also going to talk early adoption, what it means to be an early adopter of a product. So we're going to be a little bit broad, a little bit narrow today. We're going to call this a hybrid episode. And then just know, moving forward, we will have two clear delineations here between the specific versus the broad topics.
Yeah. So why don't we bring my dad and Justin in the
Let's
studio and get started?
Let's do it. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Full of Hot and Cold Air. We are going to be talking about what it means to be an early adopter, specifically in terms of variable refrigerant flow, which is a unique HVAC commercial solution.
Yeah, and so today joined in the studio, I guess is that's what we're calling this place. With us, we've got
the
fish tank. We've got my dad, David Heckler, joining us again, president of Comfort Supply. And also joining us, we've got Justin Kern. Justin, why don't you talk a little bit about your title and how long you've been with Comfort Supply and what you do for us?
Yeah, my name's Justin Kern. I've been with Comfort Supply for going on 12 years this October. And official title is Senior Commercial Sales Engineer. I started back in 2006 at the counter doing warranty, parts, stuff like that. And then through the time, Dave, in the growth of VRF, just started giving me plans and manuals and answering the phone, helping him, you know, on jobs and stuff like that, helping contractors,
right.
Engineers, you know, reading all the manuals, all the books, and eventually grew into what I do now.
So you're kind of very similar to Brendan. You had to start with the grunt work and work your way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
so,
not uncommon.
At yeah. And I think most of it too is because I was younger.
Right.
And knew a little bit more about computers than what Dave did. So
I think most people do.
So he'd be like, "Go program this controller, or help this guy with the backnet." And I had no idea. I just read the manual and open the computer up, and away we would go.
Sure.
So
we do a lot of things around here. Yeah, we do a lot of things. Just figure it out on the fly.
Yeah.
All right. So 12 years. Wow. Okay. Been a while.
Yeah.
So today we're talking about variable refrigerant flow, AKA VRF, which is, I know, one of Dave's very favorite topics in the whole, maybe aside from the English beat, it's his favorite thing in the world to talk about. So give us a quick background. VRF, like, where did it come from? What is it?
Yeah, so it started in the early 80s in Japan. Basically kind of spawned off of ductless technology, and I think ductless technology started way before then. I'm not sure the exact date. I would think in the 60s, probably in Asia. So in the early 80s, it was developed, and it was really an idea to connect multiple indoor units to larger outdoor units was kind of the first step, and then also to exchange the energy where some could be in heating, some could be in cooling at the same time. And it really took off in Asia at that point, and there were some early studies showing the efficiency much higher than conventional systems and chillers, really, at that point, and kind of took off in Asia way before it entered the U.S. market.
Okay, so so you said it started in Asia, and then when did the U.S. adopt VRF?
So kind of that early adopter, we were involved in a prototype system in 1993, which was pretty early, and we were doing a lot of ductless split systems and multi-port systems, and we ran into Mitsubishi at the ASHRAE show, and they had a system from Europe, and they basically said, "We don't want to send it back. Do you guys want it?" So again, that early adopter, or that just go at it, we said, "Sure, we'll take it."
Nice.
So 93 was kind of a prototype system, unofficial prototype, I think, with Mitsubishi.
So did they just give you this system?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Okay. Yeah, with a letter that said, "Don't ever call us. Don't ever." There is no warranty, But no, they helped us get it installed. We put it in a mechanical contractor's office around the corner, and it really, made us excited to feel and touch the technology.
So why do you think why do you think it took so long for the U.S. to adopt it? Was it just a matter of, like, that was the way of the world back in the 80s and 90s? We didn't have e-commerce and we didn't really know about it, or was there just a different demand?
I think the ductless really hadn't taken off in the U.S. at that point. It was used very niche and spotty, and so I think it wasn't, that part wasn't even pushing the VRF side. And I think it was just the timing, and I think also it was traditional companies that manufacture it are going to do massive amounts of testing and very conservative on entering a market that's been traditional, and it's been a little less traditional, I think, today with the speed of markets, but in the day that was very, they would study it for years and years and years before they'd consider it. So it commercially became available in 2001.
Yeah, I think you said many times before, Dave, that they're more of an engineering company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting because I think, especially with products like that are used commercially and residentially, like, for example, low-flow toilets really aren't a thing here in the U.S., right. But you go anywhere else in the world and that's the standard. So it seems like this is pretty similar. Everywhere else was using it, and then we were the last to jump on board, maybe.
Yep.
So what products then did VRF replace or improve upon? Who did they kind of nudge out of the market?
I think there was a couple different answers to that. One is multiple outdoor mini splits to some extent early on. It was simply like, hey, I can give you a unit that you connect 20 of these to instead of having 20 units sitting around your building. That was pretty rudimentary, but sometimes I think when you're pioneering something, you are looking for every you know, avenue to get it going. So I would say multi, to some degree, multi-port mini splits or individual mini splits. And then I think it, the other part was, I think, especially at the beginning, it was small tonnage systems, and it would be generally small rooftop probably systems that would be 8 or 10 tons, and be much easier. Well, it wouldn't be much easier to do the VRF, but it would give you much more features than that standard rooftop. That was probably the early, you know, one outdoor at a time with 8 indoors. That was probably the norm.
Yeah.
So what kind of building would that be then? You're speaking in terms of tonnage, but mm-hmm. Like what would be a real world example of that?
Small office, any kind of small office, like maybe attached to manufacturing or a school. An admin area of schools has been a big one from day one. Small areas anywhere, and then even going backwards on the early days of Douglas, where they were kind of problem solvers, but anywhere that you know is trouble to get ductwork or heat or cool, but you're able to do it with ductless, but with less outdoor parts and pieces, I guess. You know, okay. And again, that was the early days. It's changed quite a bit since.
And we'll get to how it's changed, mm-hmm. but you mentioned being, you used the word pioneer, and mm-hmm. What was that like? And pioneering a product in the United States, like is that scary? Like, how, walk us through that.
Yeah, it was. You know, I think thinking back, I had a fair amount of experience kind of doing that with ductless, you know, right. in the 80s. So it was, to me, it was kind of an extension of it. But it was, you know, there was a lot of talk and a lot of show and tell and a lot of dragging products, you know, in front of people. And a lot of, you know, trying to, it's a complicated project. Product, but trying to make it simple enough that you hit the high points that would potentially fit a job for a contractor, engineer, or owner. So there was a lot of talk, a lot of you know, we do a lot of trade shows now. We did a lot of different type of trade shows back then. So you know, we were all over Pennsylvania doing stuff like that. So it wasn't necessarily scary. It was kind of a project, and I think we were seeing some success early, so, and we felt we were with the right manufacturer, so it you know, it
made
was
it
fairly
easier,
easy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that they gave you the system, so it seems like there was kind of a low barrier to entry for you, like, hey, we have this, we might as well sell it. Mm-hmm. But at what point would you say you reached the tipping point with VRF where people were willing to maybe try a new solution to solve their problems or their issues?
I haven't really thought of that. I mean, I would guess probably.
Maybe we haven't hit it yet.
Yeah. I mean, I would guess, you know, probably 5-6 years in, you know, after that. 2001 was first commercially available. We'd do a few jobs a year. Some of them were bigger, you know. But I'd say probably 5 or 6 years in, it seemed like it started the tip to, you know, end up with 20, 30, 40 jobs a year.
So in the early days, did you have to do a lot of pre-selling then, kind of explaining what it was?
Oh,
here's
yeah.
why you want to try it, and mm-hmm. maybe some arm twisting as well?
Yeah, there was some, I'm sure, that, you know, one particular guy is like, I don't know how I ended up with this, but I have a system in play. But it was a lot of convincing and stuff, and a lot of fear, you know, the amount of refrigerant. We went through the whole R22 to R410 thing because mm-hmm. it changed with initial systems were R22. And then, so we got to go to R410, it's higher pressures. And not only were we dealing with that on the unitary side, but we're dealing with it on the mini split in this side. So, oh, I've got, you know, a lot of refrigerant in there. I'm afraid of it, that kind of thing. So I think that made us grow our support and our technical because we had to. You know what I mean? If it was just conventional systems, we maybe didn't have to grow that as aggressive that early,
yeah.
you know.
And Justin, so that would have been, he's saying that tipping point was 2007, 2008, I guess. So you would have been kind of really starting to really get your feet wet here at Comfort Supply. What
yeah.
was kind of your perspective around that time frame?
I saw a lot of projects, a lot of bigger projects. He would give me a folder, just a regular folder with all these pieces of paper in it. And I know how I don't want to say complicated, but how intense the install can be. A lot of the questions, because
right.
when you're pioneering, you know, a product in this market, all these guys have all these questions,
sure.
and you're going through all these papers. So, you know, I think that's where we started to see us push into the inside office part of it, being more organized, mm-hmm. you know, having the information readily available to give to someone, you know, so when they call and you have to give them an answer, they're not like, where do I, you
yeah.
know,
yeah, it almost how long forced, is it gonna take? Forced us to step up yeah. our game a little
so,
bit.
So, and then, you know, we had inside tech then, and then, you know, all of a sudden we hired an, you know, another tech and, you know, doing startups, and I filled in on startups too. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I think around that time, Dave, you're hitting right on the head,
mm-hmm.
you know, when it started to really take off.
So you really had to, there was a lot of education on the back end then, making sure that you guys knew exactly what the heck you were talking about, because
yeah.
people were going to call and be like, I don't even know what this is, explain it to me. And if yeah. you don't have mm-hmm. a good answer, they're
right.
like, yeah, on to the next product, please.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's when we developed the checklist too. And we go out to a job site and meet the contractor, go through the checklist, and we always changed that. And we always took stuff off, put stuff on,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, we definitely adapted through the time.
Going off topic here, I guess a question for both of you would be, when you were pioneering this, when it was coming out, was there ever a fear of like, oh man, we're hitching to this wagon and we don't know where it's going to go. Maybe it's going to work. Maybe it won't. Or did you always sort of intrinsically know that this is going to be the next big thing in commercial HVAC and we're just going to be the first to market with it?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think we're afraid. I don't think we were ever afraid. I think we were always like, this is an awesome product. If it's installed correctly and designed correctly, it's going to be a phenomenal system for your building.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely efficient, you know, modern looking. It's you don't see, you know, ductwork or anything
right. running checks all your the building. Boxes.
Yeah. So and just the sheer efficiency. It's quiet. The different zones. It fits a lot of what the U.S. buildings are now, you know, smaller mm-hmm. offices, larger offices, it doesn't really matter, you know. And then also they have other systems that you can do churches, larger rooms with. It's really adaptable to any type of mm-hmm. building. And certainly we're not going to try to, you know, put it into an application where it's not going to fit,
right.
you mm-hmm. know, so.
So you always knew then that, like, okay, this is a good product. You weren't pandering something that, like, it might work, it might not work. You,
yeah.
you really believed it. And I think
no, we were all in from day one.
That's yeah. important, because, you know, if you're going to be first to market and you're going to pioneer something like that, you really have to believe in it, because if you're half-assing it, for lack of a better word,
right.
people are going to see through that and be like, no, I don't.
You said
don't
no
think
swearing.
So. Oh, I did. we'll bleep me out afterwards.
You know, the one thing, it kind of was weird too, that it was kind of a telltale thing that as the ductless was growing and the VRF wasn't here yet, but it was in, you know, prototype, Bud Nardello kept saying, like, this product is built for you guys, you know. He kept saying, like, this is coming, I'm fighting for it. And it was kind of a I think when he saw our success, I think he felt, you know, he kind of was pushed that for them, and he really, you know, he just kept saying, like, he would tell other, you know, distributors or whatever, he'd be like, this was set up for those guys. It was the right product at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So certainly we've attributed a lot of our success to VRF and being an early adopter.
Yeah.
So, Justin, where would you say VRF is now versus when you started 12 years ago in terms of the product life cycle? How much has it evolved? Has it gotten, I mean, obviously it's gotten more efficient, but does VRF of today look anything like it did 12 years ago? Or
yeah, I think as far as the indoor units go, they all pretty much look the same. They are changing how they look, you know, sleeker edges, different styles of indoors, different finishes to the product. Even on the regular 1-to-1 mini splits, they have, you know, more of a modern style looking unit. So, and now we have, you know, air handlers, like a regular furnace style
yep.
air handler now. Whether it's the residential side where they want to be the whole house heating and cooling that is available, and then also on the commercial side, we can do, you know, apartment buildings and things like that with a regular air handler, and you still get the same efficiencies that you would with a VRF system. So they're adapting to be able to provide heat and cooling to any style of building.
Okay. I think one of the, to talk about the design, one of the really unique things about HVAC is you're designing something that people don't want to see. So right. It has to look nice, but ultimately you really don't want to see it at all. You want to just be able to walk into a room and you're not looking at a vent and you're not, mm-hmm. you know, your eye isn't drawn to that. So
yeah.
You know, it's certainly good to see that over the years they've evolved to make it a little bit more camouflaged and that, if you're, mm-hmm. yeah,
well, and I think consumers and building owners have evolved to maybe not notice
something on,
you know,
I agree.
Something on the wall agree. Because yeah. you know, even when you do get in the VRF product, there are, you know, wall mounted units mm-hmm. and floor mounted units that do stick out. And I think as a consumer base, that appreciation for the efficiency, maybe you guys can speak a little to that, has maybe softened that. You know, that demand for, you know, the, you can't see it at all, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the, that is, can be a trade-off, and I think the efficiency is certainly, you know, people, like a wall mount or a floor mount or whatever is definitely more acceptable now than it ever was. We got a hotel going on that's all wall mounts coming in. It's more of a sleek kind of building that, you know, they kind of industrial looking, so they're like, what's the difference whether that's on the wall or there's a pipe on the wall or whatever. So I think that people are it's just more accepting, and I think they, you know, they know the efficiency side there. I mean, with any ductless product, you're going to have no duct losses, you know, in terms of efficiency, and as soon as you have any type of duct work, unless it's totally hermetically sealed, you're going to have some kind of efficiency losses right out of the gate. So sure. it's a trade-off, but I think it is becoming way more, yeah, way more acceptable. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I think in commercial buildings, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes in a house, even my wife's like, I don't want to see anything on the wall,
right?
You know, so, but I think with the industrial style buildings and everything exposed and seeing steel beams and conduit, I think it's more acceptable. But certainly there are some building owners like, no, I don't want to see anything. You know, but we have products to serve that.
Absolutely. And now when we talk about the look versus the efficiency, and so let's go to the completely other end of the spectrum and talk about, Dad, your favorite topic, the green building initiative and passive buildings and things yeah. of that nature. How does, how does VRF maybe currently play into that, and where do you see VRF fitting in as that market, I'm sure, continues to mm-hmm. to grow and evolve around the country?
Yeah, so I think the passive in particularly has really been a hot topic lately, and you know, started off in Europe and started off maybe in single family homes, and I know Mitsubishi's done a, you know, very aggressive job and worked with those guys and stuff on the single family homes. It really hasn't the VRF has only been more of a recent development, I'd say, in the mm-hmm. last 5 years with the passive. So it seems like there's starting to be a real push to do some multifamily passive houses or projects and dorms as well. So all of a sudden the VRF is a really good fit because you can put very small units in and very high efficient. And it seems like it's moving kind of like a lot of things, like it's coming from the coasts and it's, you know, moving to the center of the country. So we're starting to see, I made a couple notes today, we've done, completed one job, and we've got two more that are passive multifamily. So three for us, that's a nice, you know, that's a solid thing. But I know in the on the coast, it's pretty active right
sure,
now.
Sure. And Justin, what about, I know you've worked on a couple lead projects, correct? How does that lead compare to passive, if, you know, for some people, if there's anyone listening that maybe doesn't know the difference from outside mm-hmm. the industry?
Yeah, I think passive, it's a much more
rigorous
building, you know, in general. It's very, very tight, very, very efficient building. And like what Dave said, you don't need large units to mm-hmm. heat or cool it. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes we've even questioned it during design. We're like, okay, we see this room, I think they're going to need a bigger unit. And We say, okay, we'll just go with the loads here. Yeah. You know, with lead, they're looking at all kind of different things. It has a bike rack and mm-hmm. things like that, and you know, outside. And I think lead's becoming less and less what we right. see in our market. And I think that's throughout the whole country, mm-hmm. and it's more going more passive.
And the passive, a lot of times the, and it could be a house, it could be a building, is there's more heat coming off those lights than you need. You don't even need
right.
a unit.
Right.
So that's why the unit gets so small. So mm-hmm. it'd be like this room here saying, well, that's really going to heat us all year long. So it's that aggressive. There's actually some talk that units have been oversized and they've caused, you know, some humidity problems, and so they think there's a drive to all the manufacturers to make smaller and smaller units.
And they are. I mean, yeah. you have a yeah. really small unit coming out.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So, well, that ties into my next question, which is about forecasting. Where is it going? But let's start specifically with green building initiatives. Do you think that's a trend that's going to continue, or is it just maybe the yeah. the topic du jour that...
No, I think it's going to continue. I mean, I think it's here to stay. I think, you know, it's only going to get tighter and more efficient. I think, yeah. I mean, we get calls every day for it. I think there's no turning back on that. It may not be as severe as some places. I think certain areas of the country have got local codes and local stuff that dictate that. Certain areas of Europe are much more concentrated on different parts of the green that the U.S. isn't. But I don't think it's going to go backwards. But it's not every job, per se. And there's a political part of it that's not even political. It's that the owner says, I want to show I have a green building. You know what I mean? Whether they're... like truly a believer or they're not, it's a PR thing, you know. Yeah, it works all different angles. That's fine. But yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely continuing, and it fits with a lot of our products.
Well, that's true. I think a lot of times, like with anything, you know, environmentally friendly, it took a while for people to catch on to it, and they had to like make it sexy, quote unquote, mm-hmm. before people would really buy in. So 20 years ago, like, recycling, people didn't really care about that, and energy efficiency, it was like, we don't need to worry about it, who cares. And I think now we're at the point where if you're not efficient, you're not really future proofing yourself, so it seems like we're pretty well positioned then for the mm-hmm. future in terms of
I think buildings. You know, the energy efficiency initiatives of obviously it's a core part of our the growth of our products, but I mean, the other thing I think is whether it's ductless or VRF, is there's still a component that is a problem solver. Like, I've tried every other solution. I spent tons of money, you know, maybe this will solve a problem. And initially, that was a big part of the business. Mm-hmm. And I think even with ductless, I mean, going way back. So I think that's still there, and it's under the right. I always, when I'm talking to contractors and engineers, I'm like, do what you can to qualify this owner, because, you know, they can have a lot of problems, a lot of requests, but, you know, where does their budget fit with it? And there's a ton of different ways to do it with ductless or VRF, but, you know, it may just be a pain, like take away the pain point. Is that might be as simple as that. He may care about efficiency, but that may not be his number one thing. I'll never forget, years ago, I did a presentation to a board of a nursing home with a contractor, spent weeks doing this stuff, and I went in, I didn't spend a lot of time with the owner up front, I just threw the contractor, and it was a large VRF project, and I was ready to go in there talking efficiency, and the guy said, look, I don't care about our utility bills, actually, if some weird thing, if we spend more on utilities, it's better for our bottom line or something. And I'm like, well, let's take that prezo and just throw that away. Mm-hmm. What's our next strategy? You know, but I kept even going back to it to try to bring him back. And he's like, no, I'm sorry, Dave. I just really don't care about that. And I'm like, oh, Great, so.
Well, that is interesting because, like, with VRF and ductless, there is a higher upfront cost, but in the long term, it saves. How does that affect the way you sell something? Because I think a lot of times people will look at the initial price tag and they're like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. So is there...
Yeah. I mean, I think 10 years ago, that was probably a big sticking point. Sure. Was just the pricing. You know, it's quote-unquote expensive, mm-hmm. you know. But I think, you know, competition, the market, the growth, everything has brought pricing somewhat down and more competitive. I think there's a way, okay, you want all these different zones, you want to heat and cool at the same time, you want a stat in every room. I mean, mm-hmm. you're gonna pay for it. You know what I mean? Versus a rooftop unit or something like that. So I think the pricing aspect of it has calmed down mm-hmm. in the past 5 years. I don't know, Dave, if you...
Yeah, I always say, like, are we trying sometimes, or our contractors or engineers, to put a square peg in a round hole? Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're trying to talk them out of VRF, you know,
right.
even though I want it on every job. But
yeah.
And it used to be probably 10 years ago, somebody would say, hey, I got this problem, you know, within the office. I'm like, VRF. He's like, you say that on every job. But I think, again, going back to qualifying what their needs are, what's important to them is key. And I think, yeah, I mean,
versus
I agree.
Their budget.
Yeah, you know? I think the pricing has gone down. So yeah. I think that's made it proliferated.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if someone's looking at VRF versus, you know, P-Tax, yeah, VRF is going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, I mean, you got to look at VRF worth versus, you know, water source heat pumps or, you know, a geothermal system.
I think a lot of it, too, probably depends on consumer behavior, because if you look back even, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I'll use like Walmart as an example. They were kind of the king and everybody wanted what was cheapest and they didn't really care about quality. You know, why would I spend $20 for this when I could get it at Walmart for $10? So similar to that, I think people were really only looking at the upfront cost and not in terms of cost of replacement, cost of ownership. So there's definitely been a shift in gears. People are willing to spend mm-hmm. a little bit more upfront if they know that it's going to work and they're not going to need to call a service tech out in 6 months because something broke. So.
Yeah, and it's going to lower their bills.
Yeah.
Right.
And to that replacement point, Mary Beth, what would you guys say? I mean, is it a fair mix of guys using VRF to replace old systems, new buildings? How does that mix break down for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I would say right now it's about 50-50 new buildings and existing. Originally, it was 98% existing, you know, because we were more or less, again, just kind of solving problems. Mm-hmm. I know that, not discounting those early jobs, they were very successful, but it definitely was that route. Now, I think it's a combination of the energy efficiency and the comfort and the just the whole value proposition to the owner for the new building. So in that case, you know, the engineer, the contractor is evaluating two or three or four different systems, types of systems, and trying to figure out what the best one is. And, you know, now we're at that table for certain size jobs every day as a major consideration. Whereas,
sure.
Well, you know, 15 years ago, it was like, what? I'm not going to try that there. So we've eaten into that on the new side, and the jobs, some jobs do get, you know, larger and larger. So.
Yeah, and I think, would you guys say that Comfort Supply, being an early adopter of VRF, has, I mean, it might sound obvious, but Justin, does it help you do your job on a daily basis, our long tenure with the product and having dove all in at such an early time
yeah.
in the product life cycle?
Yeah, because they know that we're not going anywhere,
right.
You know, and that we're going to be here and we're going to support the product. I mean, that's really the biggest thing. I mean, I was out on a job today and, you know, looking at this building and saying yay or nay, you know, do this, do that, helping the contractor out. And then, you know, we also then behind that building are doing a VRF job, and it's half old construction and half new construction on this house. And, it's a perfect application
cool.
for it. Yeah, but yeah, definitely.
You know, to kind of generalize that, I think it gives some credit to being an early adopter and showing that you can use that to make yourself an expert at something in the long run. You know, you can't become an expert overnight, and we've certainly sharpened our tools along the way. So I guess kind of in touching on that, and we can all maybe go around the table and answer it, what advice would you give someone that is thinking about maybe becoming an early adopter of a groundbreaking technology or product, either within HVAC or just in general?
Mm-hmm. I think it's work. You got to work. Yeah. I mean, you got to push it out there. You got to push the product out there. If it's something you think it's going to be revolutionary in your industry, you got to, you know, work it. Whether it's like what Dave did back in the day, driving the sample around, a whole Walmart and you carrying it around. I mean, you got to work. You know,
hustle.
Yeah, hustle.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to have, you know, even if it's for as small as your team is, or if it's your team's yourself, is that, you know, you got to truly believe in it. You know, I think that's number one. If you don't believe in it, you're not going to be able to convey that.
Right.
You got to evangelize it.
Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah.
I think it's sort of similar is, I would say, maybe this podcast with Brendan mm-hmm. and I. It was this brainchild of his back in December, and we kind of talked about it, and we looked, and nobody else was doing it. And we were like, all right, well, we're either going to be one of the first to do it, or we're going to, you know, we're going to miss the boat,
right.
So to speak.
No, that's a perfect example.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for me specifically, it's getting over that fear of failure,
mm-hmm.
because when we pushed out our first episode, he and I looked at each other and we're like, all right, well, here it goes. Let's hope we don't embarrass ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to be willing. What's that?
I said, I think we embarrassed ourselves.
Mm-hmm. A little bit. you have to be willing to set aside your ego a little bit and realize that you are taking a gamble, and mm-hmm. there's either going to be a great payoff or maybe it won't work out. But
or it can be somewhere in the middle. You know, I mean, it could end up that, I mean, not talking about specifically about the podcast, but I mean, there's other products we felt, I mean, we've sure. always yeah. felt we've done a pretty good job at pioneering stuff. I can give you other examples, but they all haven't been, you know, this successful. We had a lot of, you know, there's a lot of outside influences that helped, you know, where we're at on VRF now. But I mean, there's other products that I feel we do a pretty decent job of doing that. And sometimes it works and sometimes, you know, it doesn't. So, I mean, there's a lot of, there's a lot of timing and external influences that can help you either way.
For sure.
Either make you look good or bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think there's always a way to improve, whether it's mm-hmm. through the processes, through how you're doing your sales pitch, how you're doing whatever, the accounting, the manage, or the marketing, the management of whatever. You know, if you do it and then, okay, it's perfect, and you don't change or you don't adapt or you don't do anything, and you're just going to die. But if you keep on adapting and changing and trying to improve, it's going to be huge.
I was just going to say, I think it's maybe, to summarize what Dave was saying, taking a conscious gamble with something, like knowing that mm-hmm. there is the risk that it might not work, but hedging your bets a little bit. And I certainly don't want to give advice to anybody who's listening and be like, all right, go all in on your project and mm-hmm. drain your savings account and all of that, because that might not be what's best for everybody. But if you're willing to sacrifice a little bit, the rewards are plenty.
Sometimes that pressure actually helps you too, though.
Alrighty. Any final thoughts?
I want to thank you guys. It helped me talk about this, helped me, kind of reinvigorate myself. Not that I needed it, but today. At
go
least,
and sell something.
Yeah, I got to sell something. So it felt good talking about those, the old days and the start of it and, you know, where we're at now. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to this week's episode of Full of Hot and Cold Air. Do you have a question, or would you like to be featured on a future episode? Get in touch with us. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at FOHAPod. You can also email us at FOHAPod@CSIPGH.com. Remember, that's FOHAPod. Until next time.